a nation that's risen up over the killing of a fish seller this weekend. You can go to democracynow.org. Also, on election night, November 8th, Democracy Now! Will be doing a five-hour live broadcast from 7 to midnight Eastern Time. Check our website for all the details. All TV and radio stations can run that broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Noreen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
On November 4th and November 18th, from 8 p.m. until 10, From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we will focus on Mr. Gil Scott-Heron. Gil Scott-Heron established the attitude and stylistic vocabulary of socially conscious music in America. His music was powerful, his lyrics relevant, and his voice beautiful. We will also submit a musical goodbye and a love letter to President Barack Obama. So join us from the Grassroots, November 14th and November 18th from 8 to 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of protesters marched on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers office in downtown Portland this morning to make a statement against the U.S. government's crackdown on indigenous water protectors at Standing Rock, North Dakota.
Single-payer activists have their eye on the implosion of the Affordable Care Act. We speak live with Lisa Stiller of Healthcare for All.
And you're thinking about traveling to Standing Rock? First, listen to John Shuck's interview with Native American activist Tawasi Sos about the conditions there.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 31st, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Over 300 people came together in the Lloyd Center District earlier today to call on the Army Corps of Engineers to deny a permit for construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline under Lake Owyhee on the Missouri River. A largely woman-led demonstration with a significant Portland area indigenous presence gathered at 11 a.m. in Holiday Park and then marched to the nearby office of the Corps of Engineers. Native Elder John Nelson, whose grandson is Dave Archambault, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, open things up.
Our people are gathered together. I got a niece up there. She's been thrown in jail 3 times. She said when I get out, I'm going right back up to the front lines. I got several grandkids up there. My son's up there. They're up there fighting for us. And we have to support them. It's a peaceful fight.
The Corps of Engineers originally approved the pipeline river crossing in July over the objections of the EPA, the Department of the Interior, and the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. After the Standing Rock Tribe filed suit, a federal judge denied a request for a temporary injunction to halt construction on either side of the river until the case could be heard in court. That same afternoon, a virtually unprecedented joint declaration was issued by the Departments of Justice, the Army, and the Interior, stating that pipeline construction would not be authorized on Corps-controlled land bordering or under Lake Owyhee until it could reconsider any of its previous decisions regarding the site. The declaration also asked the pipeline company to voluntarily halt construction within 20 miles on either side of the river. The company has clearly refused that request as they continue full speed ahead on pipeline construction, even working through the night trying to meet their January deadline for completion. While the Corps of Engineers continues their review of the river crossing, opposition to the pipeline has grown into a major nationwide movement. Native people and their allies across the world see this as an historic moment to break through marginalization and invisibility and to fight against the pollution of the land and waters of indigenous homelands. Delia Sanchez, a non-federally recognized Multnomah Chinook, spoke about the Corps of Engineers' role both in the Dakota Access Pipeline and the damming of her ancestral Nechewana or Columbia River.
They dammed and blocked up every single river for barging. And they're manipulating our salmon runs. They're messing with our salmon runs. And this is something that's going on, and they know what they've been doing. And they know that they hold the power to change this, to make the decision to stop this, to stop violating the indigenous people of this continent. Because we are not going to stand for it anymore. We stand here in unity and love and power and prayer. And we can thank
At the end of the rally, around 50 people marched around the building chanting, "Water is life," the main slogan of the No DAPL movement. After a brief scuffle at the north door, they were able to enter the building.
Water is life! Water is life! Water is life! Water is life! Water is life!
Revoke it! Only you have the power to revoke that permit! Revoke that permit for the Dakota Access! We know you hear us. Revoke those faulty, treaty-broken permits. Tell that Dakota Access, tell the Army Corps of Engineers to come down and acknowledge us because they're broken treaties on a river that's not charged.
That was audio from the demonstration earlier today at the Army Corps of Engineers with Paul Rowland reporting.
One of the more obscure measures on the Multnomah County ballot this November, Measure 26185, would change the pool of people from which charter review committees are chosen. Here to talk about the measure is Gary Marschke. Gary, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Gary, what does Measure 26185 do?
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it. It does remove responsibility for recruiting and convening the Charter Review Committee from the chair's office, the county chair's office, and gives it to the Office of Citizen Involvement. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
And to somebody like me, that's somewhat convoluted. I mean, not the way you explained it, but what the measure does. And it seems to be the measure people are not talking about. Why would that be?
Well, I think, you know, largely we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know what questions to ask. In this case, what we're looking at is there's currently no formal process for selection of candidates who are appointed to the Charter Review Commission. The county charter is like the Constitution of the United States to the county. And it's reviewed every 6 years by a group of people called the Charter Review Committee. These Charter Review Committee members are currently selected by state legislators from a pool of candidates that are given to them by the county chair. It's kind of like the fox filling the hen house, okay, is kind of the way I describe it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to be abused, but it certainly doesn't have the, I guess what I would call the illusion of inclusion. It doesn't necessarily have the taste of total transparency. So in this case, what they're saying is we want the recruitment responsibility taken from the chair's office and given to the Office of Citizen Involvement, whose only job it is to facilitate community engagement and county policy decision making. So it seems to be a natural place for it. And then what they would do is they would recruit the pool of candidates, submit them, potentially a broader and more diverse one, to the legislators. The legislators would appoint the committee, and then the Office of Citizen Involvement would convene the committee, instead of the way it is now, which is the chair's office and the county attorney's office, which convene the committee. Over the course of the year, they make recommendations based on what you see in the ballot now for county ordinances and changes. They make recommendations for changes to the county charter. They go in front of the voters, and then they're done for the next 6 years.
I think what confused me when I was reading about it is in both cases, the state legislators will make the appointments. But if this ballot measure passes, they'll have a wider pool or a different pool of candidates to select from?
That's exactly it. That doesn't sound like you're confused at all.
Oh, okay.
Sounds like exactly what it is.
So if somebody wanted to kind of load the committee with people who were favorable to an issue or so that they wanted to support, they could still do that, even if this measure passes.
Well, certainly we don't control who the state legislators appoint. The way that we feel, those of us that support Measure 26-185 at least, and that type of open, inclusive, and transparent community engagement, feel as though whatever pool of candidates the legislators get, if we give them a broad, disparate, and diverse pool of candidates, we are far more likely to have a charter review commission or committee that represents and reflects the community at large. One of the pieces of feedback that we heard from not more than one of the committee members this past time was that there weren't people at the table on the committee that really kind of reflected the community they lived in. So that's really going to give us the opportunity to select, have our legislators select from a broader pool of candidates. If we end up with a hand-picked group of people, it will be at least far more transparent than it was in the past.
And to give KBOO listeners a sense of how important this review is, what are some of the issues that have come up previously through charter reviews?
Well, we've got issues that are on the ballot right now, of course, which are elected versus appointed sheriff. There are issues around term limits. Right now, there's a measure that would extend the term limit from 2 to 3 terms. There are other issues. This particular issue around how the Charter Review Commission is selected has not really come up before. It was brought up by one of the committee members as an issue that they would like to look at and investigate, because in looking around the room, it didn't, you know, the room didn't look like it reflected the community. So there's a real opportunity here for folks not just to take on the usual suspects of issues like the elected sheriff or term limits, but to really dig in and look at the charter and see if it's even relevant in some areas anymore. This is not the same community it was back in 1984 when this particular charter in its core was adopted. So, yeah, it's an opportunity to really have community input and engagement around something as fundamental as the county charter.
And certainly it would add, hopefully add more diversity to this.
That's exactly the point.
Now, going by the voter's guide and some of the research I've done, I couldn't find anybody who opposed it. And the papers like Willamette Week, even the Portland Tribune that supported it, called it basically a housekeeping measure, almost a no-brainer. You of course, you'd vote for it. But has there been any behind-the-scenes drama about the measure?
Well, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it drama, because certainly, as you might imagine, when you're dealing with any form of government, there's always going to be some things going on behind the scenes. In this particular instance, to me, the importance of people understanding Measure 26-185 and the impact that it has on the Charter Review Commission and the county charter is that the Citizen Involvement Committee, which is the committee that operates the Office of Citizen Involvement, is also one that is appointed by the county commissioners and is recruited in a similar fashion to the way the Charter Review Commission would be recruited. However, since the appointments here in the Citizen Involvement Committee are made by the county commissioners, there's also an opportunity there to control the process and therefore the outcome. Another opportunity for the fox to start recruiting and filling the hen house. And so by creating awareness of this measure and its importance, the hope is that we can cast an even larger light on what's happening within the Citizen Involvement Committee and the Office of Citizen Involvement on an ongoing basis as well.
Now, you pretty much alluded to this, but for those who wish there were a bigger presence of people of color represented by our local government agencies, what do you think it will really take for that to happen?
I think they really need to speak up and show up. The door is opened. It has been, and it certainly should continue to be open for community engagement, being aware of and taking a position on issues like Measure 26-185, even though it seems like there's no opposition to it, and also getting involved, getting engaged in county government. The Office of Citizen Involvement and the Citizen Involvement Committee is one way, but there are many, many other ways to get involved in local issues.
Now, you also mentioned this before, not specifically, but what specifically are some crucial Multnomah County ballot measures we should be watching?
Well, you know, there's a number of them in there. I think, you know, one of the ones that I suppose is 184, which is the one around campaign financing. I think that's a really critical measure. There's the usual suspects.
And that would limit campaign financing.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yes vote.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that certainly would be something that those who want campaign finance reform would want to vote yes on.
Hmm.
I think the two biggies are, of course, the appointed versus elected sheriff. And really the one that I found interesting, more interesting than the other one, which was the term limit going from two consecutive to three consecutive terms. And I do remember being at a charter review commission or committee meeting where that was discussed. And Commissioner Shipwreck happened to be there and offered a perspective that I hadn't heard before, which was, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're not into it, one term is way too long.
Uh-huh.
If you're really passionate, two terms is never enough. And I thought to myself, you know, that really is an interesting perspective to have. And you never know that until they're in. And I would certainly love to be able to give them, especially someone who runs for office and exposes themselves to that type of scrutiny, as well as enjoying the privilege of that office. I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt. And if we do exercise our options at election time, we can always let them know we changed our minds.
Now, leaving our KBOO listeners, I know a lot of us are filling out our ballots. My wife and I did that over the weekend, and it's a luxury.
Mm-hmm.
We all enjoy in Oregon to be able to do that. What's the most important thing you think people should take away from this discussion on Measure 26-185?
I think the most important thing is to ensure that you are seeing transparency, inclusion, and equity in all public engagement, whether it's your county, whether it's your city, whether it's metro, the state, anything that affects your quality of life in your community, you should be seeing inclusive and equitable public engagement around it, or it shouldn't happen.
And one last question, Gary, and you and I were talking a little bit about this before the interview, before we started on the air. Since there doesn't seem to be any really organized opposition to it, people might get slack or lazy and not vote yes or no, but that would not be a good thing, in other words.
The
more yeses, the better for this?
Absolutely, because what it really does is it demonstrates that type of inclusion and transparency and equity and public engagement is important to people in this community. And we feel as though it is. Those of us that are behind measures like this, we really feel as though that's critical. The more people that we have at the table and the more diverse perspectives we have, the better decisions we make. It's that simple.
That was Gary Marschke. And again, Gary, thanks very much for coming into KBOO. Oh,
thank you so much for indulging me.
And he was speaking about Multnomah County Measure 26-185. As most of you know, and you probably can't wait for it to be over. Election Day is next Tuesday, November 8th. You can find out more about the candidates and the measures online at OregonVotes.gov. That's OregonVotes with an S, .gov.
The Corvallis Albany NAACP celebrated Corvallis Police Chief John Sassaman and Barry Jerkins last night at the NAACP Freedom Fund Banquet. Corvallis NAACP President Jerkins was honored with the Cal Henry Leadership Award. Sassaman was given the D. Joan Collison Distinguished Service Award for commitment to work for justice with equity and balance in the community. The Corvallis organization earlier this year helped an African-American family that was targeted by white supremacist harassment to relocate to a safer town. Last summer, the group mediated between the police department and an African-American Corvallis resident after police drew a gun on the man August 18th while they searched for someone they thought was guilty of criminal activity.
News that the Affordable Care Act is melting down has emboldened the single-payer movement. Those agitating for universal health care administered by the government, like Medicare. Here live with us in Studio 2 today to lay out the issues is Lisa Stiller. Lisa, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Lisa, can you start out by giving a fuller definition of what single-payer health care is?
Well, it can be a little bit misleading. We call it universal health care, universal coverage, meaning there's one payer, one entity like the government that kind of takes charge and administers the program. Like we have Medicare, which has a 3% overhead as opposed to 15 to 20% overhead with the insurance companies, for-profit insurance companies. So it's one entity administering the system, which makes it much more efficient and makes sure that everybody has access to the care they need.
Well, Lisa, now we have, of course, what's termed Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. How would single payer differ from that?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, I mean, it was a step in the right direction in the sense it definitely got more people covered. We got 20 million people got onto the Medicaid expansion. We saw people come into the system we never had access. So it's something that was a step in the right direction, but it's still leaving millions of people out. People who have access now through the exchange are finding that they can't afford their premiums, they can't afford their copays, they can't afford their deductibles. So while they have access, they have an insurance card, whether they can still walk into that doctor's office is still a really big issue with them. We have dental vision issues of not being covered, especially the difficulty with Medicaid, getting those things covered. We still have people with private insurance who have rising premiums. So as long as we have a for-profit system administrating or in charge of our health care, we really aren't going to have a system where everyone really does have that access. They're finding that the bankruptcies, which, you know, like 67% were medical bankruptcies before the ACA, it hasn't gone down that much because of the problem still of paying for the care.
And, of course, we had the recent headlines about 2 weeks ago where Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill, called the Affordable Care Act insane.
Yeah.
Single payer is a lot simpler.
It is. And the reason we started speaking out this past week is we found out the 25% premium hike. Again, that's playing into the costliness of the ACA. So many people came into the system, hadn't had health insurance, so they were sick and they needed medical care because they hadn't had it. And the insurance companies are realizing, wow, we can't really afford this. And they're backing out because they're for profit. And now there's some counties in Oregon that are now down to maybe two insurance companies to pick from on the exchange. And the whole idea was to be a competitive system. So the ACA is sort of almost imploding upon itself.
Now, would you say that these insurance companies would also be the biggest opposition to single payer?
Yes, definitely. Because it's a for-profit system. And it's a system based on CEOs and their income. And as you can see, they pull out when they don't get the profit. A universal coverage system is not in it for profit. They're in it to cover people. Of course, you'll want to run it efficiently. And you can see how the governments run the veterans and the Medicare system. It's pretty efficient. And I think we have a good model for that.
Now, let's run down some of the objections that people have. And we've heard these over and over again. First one is, some people say, why should I pay for someone else's health care? How would you respond to that?
Well, you already do, in a sense. You're already paying for it. Every time a person has to use the emergency room, you are paying for their health care. When you're paying into the Medicaid expansion, you're paying for their health care. So in a sense, you're doing that right now. Your premiums go up when people have to use the emergency room. So in a sense, you're going to be paying for it in a different sense. Also, when you think about it, if you think about your deductibles, your copays, everything else you need to pay for, you're actually not going to be spending any more money. When you think about the preventative aspect of a universal coverage system, you're actually going to be spending less money to some degree. So while you're covering everyone, you're also preventing them from needing long-term care. So in a way, you're making your community healthy, you're keeping your family healthy, and it's going to benefit everyone. So think of it as a benefit for all.
It seems then basically single-payer promises more coverage for more people and more affordable.
Exactly.
Than both the Affordable Care Act and whatever we had before that, which was, I guess, more kind of just for profit.
Right, exactly. And again, the Affordable Care Act, as we've seen, 20 million people put onto Medicaid expansion, which was, you know, pretty awesome thing in many ways. So we're seeing that so many people are now getting care that, you know, we can just imagine what a universal coverage system would do. Everyone would get care.
Now, you mentioned, of course, Medicare and Medicaid, which are somewhat successful programs. And yet, a lot of the objections I hear to a single-payer system is somewhat simplistic, I guess. They say it's socialism. But, mm-hmm. Of course, we probably have a lot of government programs that could be considered socialism.
Exactly.
How would you respond to them?
Well, exactly what you said. I mean, we have Medicare, Medicaid, they're government programs. Your library is a government program. Your schools, government programs. Your roads. We have many government programs that we really don't question. A lot of the nutrition programs that we know help people, they're government programs. So in a sense, it's a government program, but you still have private, and you feel doctors, you know, are still going to be self-employed. You're not going to have doctors paid by the government. I mean, their health care will be, but they're small businesses. They're advertising. They're still their own businesses. They're not going to have a doctor-owned system. So it's the payment is universal coverage, but doctors are still going to be their own employers. Even doctors' offices are going to be their own employers.
And, of course, this isn't really creating a system from whole cloth. A lot of Western countries already have a single payer.
We are one of the few, if not the only, Western democracy that does not have some sort of universal healthcare system. And what, you know, I go back a little bit. Having heard Obama talk about the ACA and having been questioned about single payer universal healthcare coverage, he actually said, we are a nation of insurance companies, and that's what we're going to remain. I remember him quoting that. Hillary Clinton, when she was running, said the same thing. We're going to keep the insurance companies. You know, he's going to improve the ACA. So we have the challenge of our leaders who feel that a for-profit system needs to stay entrenched because that's what the people want. And I think growingly you're seeing the polls are showing that people really do want a universal system.
Which kind of leads to my next question. In 2002, Oregonians got a chance to vote on a single-payer plan, ballot measure 23. It was defeated, but it would have established a statewide single-payer plan. Is that still a practical way to go? In other words, adopt a single-payer system state by state rather than through the federal government?
Many people think it is. In fact, in 2020, we will have a referendum put forward that will do something similar. You know, we're going to put that up to the people again, a universal coverage sort of system, Medicare for all, improved Medicare for all system. So, yes, a lot of people, HAO included, believe that a state-to-state approach is going to be the way it's going to happen. I think that's the way it happened in Canada. Eventually, you know, you'll hit like a point where people realize this is the way to go.
I was going to mention that. That seemed to be the most interesting thing that I learned in the past few months is that Canada, which has a single-payer system, it was adopted province by province. It wasn't the federal government there
right.
that did it. So, and also we had what is also termed Romney Care in Massachusetts, which was somewhat of an Affordable Care Act before the U.S.
Right, and the ACA was in a part based upon that.
Yeah. So your hope then as an organization is to do it through the state legislature, specifically Oregon for your
Yeah, we're going to do it through a referendum, make an attempt through a referendum in 2020.
Oh, Lisa, I'm interested in how you got started and involved with healthcare reform. And was there any kind of health insurance story that you can tell us?
Well, I've been really into this. I did a lot of lobbying for it back in the 80s, early 90s, and I personally got something happened to me back in 2007 or 2008, when I noticed a very suspicious bump on my leg and I had no health insurance. I was working part-time and no doctor would see me except for hundreds of dollars to get me in the door. And I was very suspicious. My friends were suspicious. I suspected cancer. It was 8 months before I actually got seen. And that was because accidentally I realized I was going to school and had access to student health. So for $110, which they allowed me to pay $10 a month, I got it removed, a biopsy, diagnosis, and then had to spend a lot of money getting it treated because I'd waited so long. So there you go. I mean, if I had had access right away, it would have been over with $150, $200. So.
Oh, Lisa, also, Healthcare for All is, I looked on your website, you're holding a membership meeting November 12th. Is that a good way for cable listeners to get involved?
Yeah, definitely. Go on the website, www.hjo.org. And you can find out, it's a great way to become involved, come down and see what we're about. There's so many opportunities to be involved. And as we head up to the legislative sessions and to 2020, we need all the help we can get the word out about just why we need a universal healthcare system in Oregon and the country.
Oh, Lisa, thanks very much. We've been talking with Lisa Stiller. She's with Healthcare for All. And as she mentioned, you can go online and find out more at www.hcao.org.
The Northwest Labor Press reports that a deal has been struck between the Daimler Corporation and labor unions at the multinational Portland Truck Factory. Four union contracts at Daimler expired last week. However, today's leaders of the machinist, Teamsters, painters, and SEIU unions say the new contracts represent the best terms they have had in many years, and it is locked in until 2021. The settlement came as a pleasant surprise because 3 years ago, the machinist and painters union struck the plant for 22 days during contract negotiations. Bargaining teams told the labor press that the new contracts offer modest pay increases, better severance packages, and contributions toward the machinist pension plans. The new contract calls for a tobacco-free workplace by 2018. The Daimler truck plant was rocked over the past few years by multiple allegations of racist harassment, but the corporation settled with the state for the largest payment in Oregon history.
You're listening to the Halloween edition of the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, rainy, highs near 57 degrees. Today in history, in 1984, Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her two bodyguards. The quote of the day is from Indira Gandhi, who said, "Forgiveness is a virtue of the brave."
In the wake of the acquittal of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupiers last Thursday, much has been made over how much the verdict will embolden the right-wing anti-government movement. One of the most prominent organizations monitoring hate groups and violent extremists across the political spectrum is the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC, based in Montgomery, Alabama. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Ryan Lentz, senior writer for the SPLC Intelligence Projects, for more on how the Bundy verdict is rippling through the movement.
It's important to remember, I think, in the context of this case, that if this case, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupation does not happen if action or justice had been brought for the standoff 2 years earlier in Bunkerville, Nevada. You know, in fact, federal inaction after April 12, 2014, their inaction allowed this movement to grow. It emboldened them. It made them feel that they had chosen a position that was right with the law when it clearly was not. And even more troublesome is the reality that this verdict affirms the belief that you can manipulate, or bend this country's well-established rule of law so long as you make the proper threat.
In your observations, have you seen just since Thursday what, when you say that the movement will be more emboldened, have you seen that happening already?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen on various message boards and forums, including the Oath Keepers webpage, people have championed this as validation and justification for everything that happened. Some are even moving forward to call for justice for the Arizona rancher who was killed, Lavoie Finicum, when he rushed a police blockade and tried to pull a weapon out of his pocket. This is a group that is animated and fueled by ideas that are based on nothing but fiction. And for them to, for the jury to have decided that they're to walk free for their actions, though some still face charges in Nevada, is only an affirmation of a conspiratorial worldview.
And speaking of that worldview, one of the things that was surprising to see, especially here in just the atmosphere of Portland, was so many people who were celebrating, who were supporting the acquittal. And in Burns, too, there were, not a majority by any means, but a noticeable amount of people. I guess there's a difference between supporting, you know, what some people might view as the correct justice and supporting their actual aims. But do you think that this is still a fringe movement, or is this becoming more mainstream?
I can't say for certain, but I will say that what we've seen during this election and in recent years is, what's often categorized as from the margins to the mainstream. It's when fringe or conspiratorial or radical extremist ideas are adopted by mainstream figures and thereby, you know, at least get the stamp or the seeming stamp of approval and even validation. And the worry is that by allowing this case to, you know, to end in acquittal, you know, it affirms for many out there that this perspective that has been endorsed by some congressmen even is valid. And if the feeling or the sentiment in the anti-government extremist movement is that they are on the right side of the law, as demonstrated by this jury acquittal, then we can only expect that other members of this movement will see the threat of violence as a suitable and viable response to their disagreement with the law.
The Bundy brothers, at least, still face a trial in Nevada probably next year. And you mentioned that that's kind of in lieu of anything having happened in the actual aftermath of that incident, the Bunkerville standoff. Do you think that whether they are charged with anything, do you think it's too late for that to have an impact and, like, slow this down, or?
Well, I mean, there is a trial forthcoming out of Nevada. We don't know. It's a different jurisdiction. It's a different jury pool. It's a different region, and for that matter, it's a different constituency with different ideas about public lands and different ways to approach it. We don't know. I mean, no one knows how that jury is going to rule or how that trial is going to go. I do think this acquittal should be worrisome for prosecutors in Nevada moving into this trial.
All right. I've been speaking with Ryan Lenz, a senior writer with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Ryan, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Crow Creek Sioux Tribe has severed ties with the state of South Dakota. The announcement came as the result of South Dakota Highway Patrol troopers being assigned to support North Dakota law enforcement personnel at the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. FSRN's Jim Kent has this report.
The Crow Creek Sioux Tribe has two legal agreements with the state of South Dakota. One is a memorandum of understanding with the South Dakota Highway Patrol. The second involves a 90-10% split with the state for administering the tribe's taxes. Crow Creek Sioux Tribal Chairman Brandon Sazu says those agreements are now null and void as a result of South Dakota Highway Patrol troopers supporting North Dakota law enforcement at the Dakota Access Pipeline protest.
In my mind, they are standing against our people by condoning what Morton County is doing. Macing our people, beating them with batons, and using their military tactics.
Sazu adds that South Dakota is also supporting Morton County overreach, charging young Lakota men and women with felony crimes, people who formerly had clean records. And since the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe is paying 10% of its taxes to the state of South Dakota, Sazu says,
they're condoning what Morton County is doing now, and when we can't be a part of that.
Chairman Sazu wishes South Dakota would be as good a neighbor to the Lakota people as it wants to be to North Dakota. South Dakota's Department of Public Safety announced today that its Highway Patrol personnel have ended their two-week deployment to the Dakota Access Pipeline site. But a standing agreement with North Dakota for law enforcement support when required means they could be sent back if requested. Jim Kent, FSRN, Hot Springs, South Dakota.
Canada and the European Union officially signed the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, known as the CETA trade deal. The trade deal has been in negotiations for the last 7 years. It was reported last week that the CETA deal had fallen through because of objections from the Belgian Parliament that have since been worked out, allowing it to be approved yesterday in Brussels. Before the trade deal becomes law, it must be ratified by the European Union Parliament and the individual parliaments of each country within the EU. Similar to the TPP currently being negotiated, the CETA deal would allow corporations to sue local and national governments for loss of profits due to environmental and labor laws. Known as the Investor-State Dispute Settlement Mechanism, the deal would create the legal framework that would allow corporations to bypass domestic courts and sue governments before a three-person tribunal.
Four Israeli army bulldozers this morning entered the Khan Yunis region of the southern Gaza Strip and leveled an agricultural area, according to the Palestinian News Network. The independent Middle East Media Center said no gunfire was reported. Israeli military incursions inside the besieged Gaza Strip and near the buffer zone, which lies on both land and sea sides of Gaza, have long been a near daily occurrence. Palestinians who work near the unilaterally declared buffer zone between the Palestinian enclave and Israel often come under fire from military forces, as the Israeli military has not made clear the precise area of the designated zone. The practice has in effect destroyed much of the agricultural sector of the blockaded coastal enclave.
Former Russia president and the 1990 Nobel Prize winner Mikhail Gorbachev stated that tensions between the U.S. and Russia were as bad as he had ever seen and urged the two governments to renew negotiations. The warning by the 85-year-old Gorbachev says comes amid reports that the U.S. is considering militarily engaging Syrian troops, which even American generals say could lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and U.S. forces. The Syrian conflict is just one of several that the U.S. and Russia are currently engaged in. As NATO troops continue to build up forces near Ukraine and the Russian border, Russia has responded that they are stating they are considering reopening an abandoned Navy base in Cuba, 90 miles off the Florida coast. The rapidly escalating tensions between the two superpowers has also caused the collapse of an arms control agreement that limited the worldwide trading of refined plutonium needed for both nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. Over the last month, Russia has moved several state-of-the-art anti-missile weapons systems to both Syria and the Eastern European border in what they are calling self-defense, but what NATO officials claim are provocative. Underscoring the renewed tensions, the Obama administration has announced its plans to spend up to $1 trillion over the next few decades upgrading its nuclear weapons systems, and last week held war games in the Nevada desert, where B-2 bombers dropped unarmed nuclear bombs on targets, simulating a future nuclear bombing attack.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Monday, October 31st, 2016. Palestinian policeman killed by Israeli gunfire in the West Bank, and meanwhile army bulldozers destroy lands in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Mohammed Turukman, 25, was killed on Monday evening when Israeli soldiers manning a checkpoint just outside the central West Bank city of Ramallah opened fire at him. Israeli sources said that Turukman was shot dead by Israeli soldiers after he opened fire at them, injuring three at military checkpoint near the illegal Israeli settlement of Beit Eil just outside Ramallah. One soldier sustained moderate wounds, while the other two were lightly wounded, Israeli sources reported. The Israeli army announced Ramallah district a closed military zone and closed all roads leading in or out of the city. According to media sources, Turukman is from Jenin district in northern West Bank and works as a police guard in the Palestinian Parliament building in Ramallah city. Israeli troops invaded Palestinian businesses and coffee shops close to the checkpoint and confiscated security camera videos. Clashes erupted between local youth and soldiers who fired tear gas, rubber-coated steel bullets. Up until the time of this report, no injuries were reported. In other news, Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn several areas in the occupied West Bank, searched homes and interrogated many Palestinians before kidnapping 11. Moreover, Israeli bulldozers from the Lashem settlement on Monday leveled lands west of Salfit in the northern occupied West Bank, while Israeli forces confiscated farming equipment in the nearby Tobas city. Elsewhere, Israeli bulldozers on Monday morning carried out a limited invasion into the Khan Yunis region in the southern Gaza Strip. Four army bulldozers launched a limited invasion into eastern Al-Khuza'a town to the east of Khan Yunis, entering 50 meters into the strip. Bulldozers then started leveling lands, new sources reported. A And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, October 31st, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Hassan Bandura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Chris Andre, Jeff Anderson, Paul Rowland, Jenna Yokoyama, John Shook, Sam Bowman, and special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis and Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show. At 9, an alternative radio, Yasmin Abdel-Majid speaks on recognizing bias. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts talks with Walter Jaffe and Paul King, founders of White Bird Dance, about the upcoming performances by Reggie Wilson and the Fist and Heel Performance Group coming to Portland. And Reggie Wilson also talks about his work. At 11:30, it's Art Focus with Andre Middleton. And at 10 p.m. tonight, tune in for a special spooky Halloween edition of the Holy Crowley Hour or Two. You might want to leave the lights on. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.